A man whom, without all the success and progress American cities have made over the last 4 years, simply would not be possible. American mayors could ask for no better friend and partner than the 46th President of the United States, Joseph R. Biden. It's easy now as cities are thriving to forget just how tough a spot we were all in just 4 years ago. It was a real life nightmare. The most disruptive global event in our lifetimes had decimated our revenues, erased millions of jobs overnight, and taken far too many lives. American mayors had a partner working hand in hand. President Biden led the most productive 4 years for American cities in our history. He delivered the American Rescue Plan that brought us back from the brink. He then helped us catapult ahead with the bipartisan infrastructure law. He made history's greatest investment in the fight against climate change in the Inflation Reduction Act. And among many other achievements, he set in motion a great renaissance of American manufacturing with the CHIPS and Science Act. It is a record that will not only stand the test of time, but had profound, tangible benefits for the people we serve and the cities we love. Today, our cities are vibrant and brimming with optimism. And for that, we cannot thank you enough for your devoted leadership. Indeed, thank you is not enough. That's why today I'm proud to announce that we are taking the very rare step of presenting to President Joe Biden the United States Conference of Mayors Award for Distinguished Public Service. This is our highest honor, and there's no more fitting recipient than President Biden. Mr. President, your legacy of achievement and support for the working people of this country will forever be celebrated. On behalf of America's mayors, we honor you and thank you for your service and for your friendship. Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States, Joseph R. Biden.
Gaylor, thank you very much from Columbus, Ohio, for your leadership of this conference. Please have a seat if you have one. Thank you, Tom Cochran, for your remarkable stewardship of the U.S. Conference of Mayors for decades. I want to give a special thanks to his wife, Clarita, who I just met. She's running around here, feeling after she broke her hip. You doing well? Anyway, Tom, you and I have something in common. We both married way above our station. My hometown mayor, John Carney. John, where are you? Out there? Wilmington, Delaware. Thank you, John. This guy's a true public servant. He just finished 8 years as a great governor and then decided to run for mayor. A special thanks to another great friend, the mayor of my second home, Scranton, Pennsylvania, Paige Cagnotti. Paige. It's an honor to receive this award. As I measure the significance of the award based on the character and the consequences of the organization bestowing the award. The U.S. Conference of Mayors is an organization of character and consequence. And thanks to all of you for your partnership and the progress we made together these 4 years. I must say, a big reason we got so much done is because all former mayors have served in my administration. Steve Benjamin, Pete Buttigieg, Marsha Fudge, Keisha Lance Bottom, Mitch Landrieu, Tom Vilsack, Marty Walsh, and thanks to Tom Perez, a guy like me who has been my point person for all of this, but he's a county guy. That's tougher, man. I don't know, man. This is one of the last events that I'll be doing as president. And the reason I chose to be here is because of the first thing that I did as president was to speak to this conference. You know, as many of you know, maybe you weren't here then, but many of you know, I started my career as a local councilman. Only ran for the Senate because it was too damn hard being a local councilman. You know, people know where you live. They think you can solve every problem. They think you got more money than you do and more power than you do. You're in the front lines answering key questions of their lives. Is my neighborhood safe? My kid going to have the good fortune to be here in his hometown? Will there be jobs here? So many other questions. It matters. What you do matters, matters, matters. When we first met 4 years ago, the pandemic was raging, and our economy was reeling. 4 years later, our nation and our cities have emerged stronger than we were when we entered the crisis. I come here today for a couple reasons. First, my administration released a report summarizing the impact of our work together to invest in America. It all started with the American Rescue Plan, one of the most significant recovery packages in our history, to get us out of the immediate crisis of the pandemic and save thousands of lives. One of the most important decisions I made was to send money directly to you. Directly to you. I've been a local official. Governors are good guys and women, but when you send it to state legislators, they divide it up before it gets to you. It goes directly to you when I do it. So you control the outcome. Then we passed the Invest in America Act. That's launching a new era of American possibilities. One of the greatest modernization of infrastructure in our history, we passed. New roads, bridges, clean water, affordable high-speed internet for every American. Now, each of you, because there's so many examples of the projects in your community, there's thousands of them. We also made the biggest investment in fighting climate change ever in the history of the world, not just America, because of you. And I think one thing we've all changed together, when I use the word here, climate, I think jobs. I think jobs when I hear climate. We're creating hundreds of thousands of good-paying, clean energy jobs. We've proven you don't have to choose between protecting the environment and growing the economy. You're doing both. We have to keep pushing forward, push forward faster. There's no time to waste. I'm with you and your governors to make the devastating hurricanes and floods and tornadoes and wildfires, like the catastrophic fires and wildfires in California. Together, we push Congress for extra disaster relief funding, to rebuild homes and businesses across the Carolinas, to cover the full cost of replacing the collapsed Key Bridge in Baltimore, and so much more. At the same time, we work with you to upgrade the power grids, plant millions of trees, build resilient communities to withstand extreme weather. Not only build, but to build back better than before. Build back better. We also made the most significant investment in science and innovation. America invented the semiconductor. Now we're bringing those chip factories back home to America where they belong. I've stood with you in Columbus, Syracuse, Phoenix, and many more fields of dreams where these fabs, these massive new factories the size of several football fields, are being built. And as I speak, you're going to create at least 125,000 good-paying jobs. And the jobs in these fabs. You're going to pay over $100,000 a year, and you don't need a college degree. You don't have to move from your hometown. You can stay where you are. If I could pause a minute, you know what's going to happen as well? When you build these factories, they're going to have to build more barbershops, beauty salons. I'm not joking. They're going to build grocery stores. They're going to build drug stores. It grows communities in a big way. We will soon be the only economy in the world to have all five of the top chip companies operating in America, creating thousands of jobs. And for the first time in decades, these new factories are producing the most advanced chips right here in America. These aren't just fabs, these investments are creating opportunities for entire communities, for small business, creating even more jobs, and so much more. I've kept my commitment to be president for all of America, whether you voted for me or not. In fact, studies show my programs have delivered more for red states than blue states. The results are clear. 16.6 million new jobs, the lowest average unemployment rate for 50 years, a record 21 million new applications to start new businesses. And every one of those applications is an act of hope in your communities. Wages are up, inflation is down, and we passed the most significant gun safety law in 30 years. We're slashing overdose deaths by 26% last year, you did it. Faster than ever, and seizing record amounts of fentanyl, making life-saving Narcan available over the counter. Violent crime is now at a 50-year low. Because of you. The bottom line, you've produced an incredible 4 years. So much we got done together. It'll take time to see and feel, though. But the seeds have been planted. Will grow and they'll bloom for decades to come, and none of it could have happened without all of you. And that's not hyperbole, none of it. You know, we're not finished yet. Earlier today, I announced three major priorities that mark important progress in our country. First, after fighting Big Pharma for decades as a senator and then the vice president as president, we finally beat Big Pharma. Instead of paying $400 a month for insulin, seniors now pay $35 a month. But that wasn't the only thing that happened when we passed the bill. Starting this month, the total prescription drug cost for seniors is capped at $2,000, no matter how expensive their drugs are. Even expensive cancer drugs that cost $10,000, $12,000, $14,000. They're not going to have to pay more than $2,000 a year. And finally, we gave Medicare the power to negotiate lower drug prices like the VA has been able to do for veterans all along. These negotiations are being implemented in phases. The first phase negotiated lower prices for the 10 most expensive drugs for seniors, covering drugs for blood costs and so much more. And just this morning, I announced the next phase, the next 15 drugs subject to negotiation. Drugs that will treat cancer, heart disease, diabetes, and so much more, including Ozempic. Hard to say. But it really is an incredible drug. These reforms just don't save seniors money. They save the American taxpayer $160 billion. The taxpayer over the next decade. Why? That $160 billion in Medicare is saving for negotiating lower drug prices in Big Pharma doesn't have to be paid out by the government. $160 billion. Second, just over 100 years ago, a pioneering group of women proposed the Equal Rights Amendment to enshrine the principles of gender equality in our Constitution. Throughout my career, I've been clear, no one should be discriminated against based on their sex. And in order for the amendment to be ratified, it requires three-fourths of the states to ratify it. That benchmark was passed when Virginia ratified the ERA a few years ago. Today, I affirm the Equal Rights Amendment to have cleared all the necessary hurdles to be added to the U.S. Constitution now. The Equal Rights Amendment is the law of the land now. It's the 28th Amendment to the Constitution now. I consulted dozens of constitutional scholars to make sure there was all within the power to do this. And the fact is, we did. And third, our cities are places for second chance. Earlier today, I commuted the sentence of nearly 2,500 convicted nonviolent drug offenders. These individuals are serving a disproportionately long and harsh sentence compared to the sentence they would receive had they committed the crime today. After spending too long behind bars, these individuals will soon be reunited with their families and communities. With this action, I make no apology. I've issued more individual pardon and commutation than any president in U.S. history. There is more work to do, but when we allow our justice system to be placed, a place of both accountability and mercy, it strengthens our cities and our nation as well, in my view. Let me close with this. Serving as your president has been the honor of my life. When my term in office is ending, the work continues. Your work continues. My farewell address 2 days ago, I talked how each of us must be guardians of democracy to restore the strength of our institutions and democracy. The presidency, the Congress, the courts all have minimum requirements under the law to deal with those safeguards. And a free and independent press, and yes, local governments. The strength of our institution depends on the character of leaders like you. In our time together, I'm forever thankful to have seen the strength, your strength and your character. And we need it now more than ever. The magic of America has been everyone has a fair shot. Everyone is determined to be able to be treated with dignity. No guarantee, just a fair shot. I've always believed America can be defined in one word. I remember being in the Tibetan Plateau with Xi Jinping. I met with him for over 90 hours alone. Traveled 17,000 miles with him. Very significant differences. He looked at me and he said, "Can you define America for me?" And I said in one word, possibilities. We're the only nation in the world. Only nation in the world. That's come out of every crisis we've ever gone in stronger than we went in. Only one. Look at the history. We're the only nation in the world that believes when we act together, there's not a damn thing we can't do. Only in America that anything is possible. You just have to remember who we are. We're the United States of America. Nothing is beyond our capacity when we do it together and act together. God bless you all. Keep working together. We need you. We need you. We need you. We need you. And may God protect our troops. Thank you so very much.
And finally, something from our friends at Native Land Podcasting.
Confirmation, confirmation, confirmation. We are a couple of days out from the shifting of administrations. And when a new president and vice president come in, yes, a whole new cabinet, a whole new staff, and all the other comes in with it. But of course, as y'all know, because we've talked about it on this podcast before, that this is a particularly special time with this Trump administration transition because these folks are also going to be trying to deepen into the government infrastructure, the employment infrastructure, to make sure that they have loyal people at every level of the government. We ought to keep our eyes out for that. But right now, let's check out some of the heads of agencies and departments who are undergoing confirmation. We began the week with Keith Hegseth.
Pete.
I think I said Keith.
Oh, Keith.
But Pete Hegseth, who is up for Secretary of the Department of Defense of these United States. And I'd love for you to take a quick look at how he was handled during one of those questioning periods here.
We have hundreds of women who are currently in the infantry, lethal members of our military serving in the infantry. But you degrade them. You say, we need moms, but not in the military, especially in combat units. You will be in charge of 3 million personnel. It is a big job. And when you make these public statements, and I get you were not Secretary of Defense then. I get you were on TV. I get you were helping veterans. I get it was a different job. But most recently, you said this in November of 2024, knowing full well you might have been named as Secretary of Defense. So please explain these types of statements, because they're brutal and they're mean and they disrespect men and women who are willing to die for this country.
I spent months talking to active duty service members, men and women, low ranks, high ranks, combat arms and not combat arms. And what each and every one of them told me, and which personal instances have shown me, is that in ways direct, indirect, overt, and subtle, standards have been changed inside infantry training units, ranger school, infantry battalions, to ensure that
give
commanders
me one example.
Meet...
Please give me an example. I get you're making these
commanders
generalized
meet
statements.
Quotas to have a certain number of female infantry officers or infantry enlisted, and that disparages those women.
Commanders do not have to meet quotas for the infantry. Commanders do not have to have a quota for women in the infantry. That does not exist. It does not exist.
Y'all, that's a brief preview of what yesterday looked like. So that was New York State Senator. New York Senator representing, obviously, the state of New York, Kirsten Gillibrand, who I have to tell you, I felt like she and the women on that committee yesterday, Mazie Hirono, and many others, even former vice presidential nominee and senator from where, Virginia?
Tim Kaine.
That was my favorite. I'm mad we're not playing that. Watch that.
Well, either way, all I want to say is I thought that, one, it was clear no Republican defected, and Hegseth is, you know, probably going to get the votes that he needs. But that was him being taken to task over his comments about women, moms not being in the military, so on and so forth, and them members of the Democratic Party holding him accountable to some of them. And it got fiery yesterday. If you didn't see that, I hope folks are able to check it out. Tiffany and Angela, I know y'all monitored it as well. What were your highlights from the hearing?
And I just want our listeners and viewers to know who is getting confirmed and for what this week. So this week on Tuesday, we just talked about Pete Hegseth, who faced the Senate and as Secretary of Defense. On Wednesday, Pam Bondi out of Florida is in confirmation hearings for Attorney General, as is Senator Marco Rubio for Secretary of State. As is former Congressman Sean Duffy of Wisconsin. He will
and of
be,
the real world.
Confirmed, yes, real world fame. he will be in confirmation hearings for Secretary of Transportation. John Ratcliffe for CIA Director. This is a big deal because, as you know, Chris Wray, the outgoing, Chris Wray is FBI.
Yeah, FBI.
The CIA Director is very important because if you watch Lioness, there are a lot of issues facing our facing our country. Chris Wright, Secretary of Energy, he's an executive of a natural gas company based in Denver. Russell Vought, Director of Office, OMB, Office of Management and Budget, which is a big deal. Scott Turner on Thursday, which is HUD. He is a former football player who served as a mid-level official in the first Trump administration. He's been elevated to lead a cabinet position. Lee Zeldin for the EPA Environmental Protection AG. Doug Burgum, another Trump loyalist, for Interior Secretary. Scott Bessent, Treasury. You can imagine that is a huge deal. Bessent. And Kristi Noem, infamously wrote about shooting her dog, her puppy, She will be facing the Senate on Friday for Homeland Security. So things are moving quickly on Capitol Hill. We obviously, by the time some of you all may listen to this, we have already, we have not talked about it because it wasn't happening at the time that we had this discussion. But pay keen attention to what's happening on Capitol Hill, because these are the people who will be leading government. Angela, have you, because the House doesn't really deal with confirmation hearings, what has traditionally been the role, I think a lot of people wonder this, of the Congressional Black Caucus, who serves in the lower chamber of the House? What has traditionally been their role with helping confirm people or trying to stop people from confirmation since they're not on the Senate side?
Yeah, so I'll take on the latter because that's the day and age we are in now. I think that their role really is to help people understand folks' records. They'll go on air. They'll talk to their colleagues in their state delegation. They will meet with people that they have friendly relationships with, such as if they share views of the Progressive Caucus or if they're in the Blue Dogs or whatever. They will meet and talk about things that they know about these individuals. Some of them have worked with these nominees. We know Pam Bondi and her role with some really tragic events in Florida. Some of the Florida delegation is certain to speak out against some of those things that she's done, including some of the ways in which she's been responsible for some massive injustice, including saying that Donald Trump actually won Pennsylvania in 2020. So you can expect to hear the Pennsylvania delegation speak out against that. They will write letters to senators and, again, talk to their friends. But there's not a formal role. They don't have any voting procedures, any hearings that they conduct on those actual nominations themselves.
And it doesn't sound like anybody can stop it. I mean, you don't. Yeah. You have Senator Joni Ernst, who is herself a survivor of abuse and sexual assault, who is willing to vote for Pete Hegseth as Secretary of Defense, who will be in charge of 3 million people and a massive budget, who has never managed more than 80 people. And he's also been accused of sexual assault, and she is voting for him. Andrew, I don't know what it will take. Like, this is not a Senate. It is a cult. These are people who are there. Every question they ask, it is on some level, are you a Trump loyalist? You know, Democrats keep asking, will you say no? And that was one of the questions. We should play this clip of Pam Bondi, because you and I disagree on how she handles this question. So let's hear from Pam Bondi, who is in confirmation hearings to become the next attorney general. Let's take a listen.
Would you have hired someone into the Florida Attorney General's office who you knew had an enemies list?
Senator, to cut to the chase, you're clearly talking about Kash Patel. I don't believe he has an enemies list.
Kash Patel has a published enemies list.
Yes.
So she has perjured herself as the next attorney general, lying to Congress when she knows full damn well that Kash Patel has an enemies list. Not only does he have his enemies list, it is published. We gonna put it up on the screen right now. Run that thing back. What does that say, Pam? You know better, Pam. Stop lying, Pam. That's all I gotta say about that.
I just want to tell the viewers, Kash Patel is who Trump has tapped to run the FBI. And he has called members of the FBI, people, employees of the FBI, the deep state. He is a person. These are all people who are out. Pam Bondi herself has said, we're going to prosecute the prosecutors. We're going to investigate the investigators. They are all trafficking on an enemies list. I am curious, from a legal perspective, can she plead ignorance? Can she say, well, I didn't know he had this published enemies list? And what's important to know about this is Kash Patel will be reporting into the DOJ. Pam Bondi will essentially be one of his bosses. They all serve at the pleasure of the president, but the FBI falls under the DOJ.
Andrew, I also think she said, guys, I don't believe
okay,
that he has.
Well, that's her legal loophole.
And quite frankly, the reason why I said she had done well or was doing well is because she was able to back out of basically everything she said leading up to this.
Has she done well, or are their questionings crappy?
We've seen her be very crafty.
She has been answering well.
She is giving Democrats and certainly the Republicans the cover they need by saying, I will be the, who's your client as the attorney general?
Yes, I do.
The Constitution and the American people are my client, right? So they're trying to say, you're going to work for Donald Trump. She says, no, the Constitution and the American people are my client. I may be asked to advise him. And then in other areas, it was, Did Joe Biden win the presidency? Joe Biden is the president, the 46th president, and Donald Trump will be the 47th president. So just these obfuscations
I don't think that was a good answer.
answer.
It wasn't a good answer. I don't think she handled it well.
She refused. What I took away from that, she refused to say that Joe Biden got a majority of the votes.
She agrees.
Is still an apology.
How do we define good? Like, are we saying good?
I think it shifted so much.
But I'm saying so low. Here's my question. How are we defining, is it a good answer? Are we saying good by the standards of integrity and what is moral and what is right? Or are we saying good and that it was effective?
Effective. Effective to this end.
Yeah.
Effective to the end that it causes no Republican senators to then jump on a line of questioning that creates what looks like an opening on the right for her to be defeated. And so far, just as it in Hegseth's confirmation, not one single Republican senator chased down a line of questioning that would have in any way held him accountable. None whatsoever. Ernst was going to be the one who probably got closest to opening the door. Mm-hmm. Didn't even open it. Closed it. Right shut. So what I mean by good is no, I think the answer is disingenuous. I think there's some credibility issues there. And, I wish there was a way to hold it a greater account. But to the point of effectiveness is, will it cause any Republicans consternation? And right now, as the American people
were
to hear that.
The consternation bar is very...
mine, but theirs.
No, I didn't say yours. She would have to go in there and like light herself on fire and roll around for them to have any consternation.
I mean, in truth, her predecessor nominee for that office gave them consternation and he dropped out, right? He had to withdraw. I'm talking about Matt Gaetz. Had to withdraw from that position. So there are some people.
Well, that's because there was a report coming out about his alleged.
But the report was always coming out, and we always knew that the man was truly
they
guilty.
They thought that they were going to be able to hold it up. Remember,
I personally did not believe that they would have success at keeping from 100 U.S. senators.
You have better faith in them.
Detail, but I don't think that detail mattered to them at all.
Right, I don't think that mattered to them. What does matter to them? I mean, the only thing that matters on the Republican side of the divide is how loyal will you be to Donald Trump?
That's it.
Yeah.
That's it. That's it.
I agree.
Yeah. Even risk of national security, how loyal will you be to Donald Trump? Pam Bondi was also, she lobbied for the country of Qatar. There are so many of Pete Hegseth, like we didn't see a full FBI background check on him.
And they still didn't release it.
And they're not going to, the other thing is, we're talking about the FBI background checks. They're also not going to have to go through the traditional security clearance process. They didn't hire a firm to make it okay for all these folks to get security clearances, whether they've had issues with the law or not. The president will have top secret and classified information available to him as a convicted felon. That is unheard of.
Can I ask you about that? Because you've gone through the security clearance process, and I'm struck by that. What is the process? Like, what are some things that they're looking for that you went through that these people might be able to bypass?
Yeah, they're looking for any issues with finances, like if you have significant debt, because if you have significant
exposure.
I ain't never getting confirmed.
Shut up. I'm not talking about confirmation. I was talking about the security clearance
process.
But I will just say, like, they're looking for significant debt because they think that folks who have significant debt are more easily bribed. They are looking for whether or not you have any felony or any significant character issues. So that's why I'm saying it is amazing to me that even to get a freaking pre-check, to get TSA pre-check, there are certain things that you can't have. To get global entry, you cannot have had a DUI on your record. Mm-hmm. All of that stuff is out the window for Trump and his cabinet picks, and arguably some of the folks that he is hiring to work in the White House that don't have to be Senate confirmed. So the bar and the standard is significantly shifting, and I wonder what happens when the proletariat realizes that the bar is shifted for some, but not for all.
I'll just say this. The high point for me is, and I know we're going to break after this, is simply that, one, the foxes are in charge of the hen houses. In every department, every secretary, every appointee there is antithetical, by and large, to the mission, and even in some cases, education, i.e., the existence of certain departments that they are now in charge of. And so what that leaves for the rest of us, one, no, there's not going to be a lot of shock and awe. It's going to be pretty awful, their efforts. But two, they still have to be held to account at every turn. We still have to make noise about it. We still have to make sure people are aware. And I think more importantly, our vigilance, our eternal vigilance, is really going to be needed on the stuff that they don't talk about out loud.
Mm-hmm.
The you know, the little bread trails they're not leaving behind. We know enough about Hegseth to know that the man don't like women. He don't like black people. He's questionable of people of color. And if he had it his way, it would be an all white male run U.S. military that basically bends to the whims of him and Donald Trump.
He will politicize the military.
It's already done. His answers yesterday were so this week were incredulous.
Native Land Pod is a production of iHeartRadio in partnership with Reason Choice Media. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite show.
As many Zionist leaders acknowledge privately, if not always publicly, anybody would oppose such a thing. Right? Any indigenous population would resist such a thing. And the more far-sighted and hard-headed of the Zionist leaders were already saying very clearly in the 1920s, of course the Arabs will oppose us. And there's no peaceful resolution to this in sight, and the only thing that will decide this is superior force.
That's Zachary Lachman, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Zachary Lachman on a brief history of Zionism. Zion is the name of a hill in ancient Jerusalem. The Jewish nationalist movement coined the term Zionism in the 1890s. Zionism got the big power backing it was looking for when Britain issued the Balfour Declaration on November 2, 1917. Arthur James Balfour, the British Foreign Secretary, stated, "His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people." This declaration became the major legal cornerstone for Zionist claims to Palestine. Two issues complicated things. At the time, 90% of Palestine's population was Arab Muslim and Christian, and only 10% Jewish. And the British were signing away land that was not theirs. Our guest today is Zachary Lachman. He's professor of Middle Eastern Studies and History at New York University. He's the author of many books, and he's contributing editor to Middle East Report. This classic from the AR archives was recorded at NYU in 2010. And now, Zachary Lachman, A Brief History of Zionism.
I think we can see Zionism as one of a whole series of different and often conflicting responses by Jews in Europe, and especially in Central and Eastern Europe, where most of the Jews lived at the time, to the situation they found themselves in the late 19th century. The great majority of Europe's Jews and of the world's Jews at that time lived in Tsarist Russia, within the Tsarist Empire, where they were discriminated against, often persecuted as Jews, and were also extremely poor in their great majority. In the process of figuring out how to respond to this situation, Zionism was one tendency that emerged. There were lots of others, and others that were much more popular at the time and for decades afterwards. For example, from the 1880s onward, after the wave of anti-Jewish pogroms that erupted in Tsarist Russia, millions of Jews picked up and left. They voted with their feet in a sense and went to other places where they hoped they could live lives that were not subject to persecution and discrimination and find economic opportunity, escape from the terrible poverty in which most Jews in the Tsarist Empire were enmeshed. And this is when we get the mass migration of Jews from Eastern Europe to the United States and to a lesser extent to Western Europe, South Africa, Argentina, and so forth. And in this sense, Jews were part of a vast wave of millions of emigrants out of Eastern and Central and Southern Europe, most of them non-Jews, escaping poverty, seeking opportunity, in some cases seeking religious or national freedom. So this was one very powerful response. A great many Jews in Eastern Europe stuck to the old ways. They continued to live deeply religious lives. They felt that whatever they endured was God's will, and as long as they lived in accordance with the laws of the Torah, God's commandments as they saw it, this is how it had to be, even as they tried to get through day to day. In Russia and elsewhere, many Jews abandoned the old ways. They felt that the old laws, the old religious commandments, were no longer relevant to their new lives. This period witnessed the spread of education, urbanization, very rapid demographic growth, and many, many Jews escaped the tutelage, the domination of their rabbis and their close-knit, tightly controlled communities, and became much more secular and sought advancement either through education, although that didn't get you very far in Tsarist Russia. There were limits to how far Jews could advance. Or they turned to movements for social change. Jews were just one of many oppressed nationalities in Tsarist Russia. And, of course, the great bulk of the population were oppressed in class terms. The great bulk of the peasant population were ruthlessly exploited by their landlords and the urban working class, which was growing very rapidly. So many Jews joined the clandestine movements, parties, organizations that fought to end Tsarist oppression, to overthrow the Tsarist regime and create a democratic and socialist Russia in which Jews with all the other oppressed nationalities would have equal rights. And this is why Jews played a very disproportionate role, a very disproportionately large role in all the movements of opposition to the Tsarist regime, including the left-wing movements, the socialist movements, including ultimately the Bolshevik movement. If we look at the Russian Revolution, the October Revolution, which brought the Bolsheviks to power in 1917, not Lenin, of course, who was the preeminent leader of the Bolsheviks, but most of his top lieutenants were Jewish. And this is because of the double oppression to which Jews were subjected in Tsarist Russia as Jews and as poor people, as poor working people. So we have a whole set of responses ranging from the hope for assimilation through education, the eradication of anti-Semitism, to revolutionary change, to emigration, to sticking to the old ways. And, of course, among all those tendencies, you have the emergence of Jewish nationalism, which comes to be called in the 1890s Zionism. And this, too, is not very surprising. If you look what goes on in Europe, across Europe, in the 19th century, this is the age of nationalism. This is the age in which one people after another develop new forms of national identity and come to feel that it's no longer acceptable for them to be ruled by people they come, by empires, by states they come to see as alien and oppressive. And so in Italy, in Germany, in Greece, in Serbia, in Poland, and these, of course, are not nation states at the time. They're empires. They're ruled by others. You have nationalist movements which seek to establish independent nation states for this new category of people, which is usually defined by its language. Right? Before the 19th century, the idea that everybody who spoke German should be in one Germany would not have occurred to anyone. Or the idea that everybody who spoke Italian in all its dialects should be within one nation state called Italy, and that nation state should be independent of the rule of Austria or the other outside powers that dominate it, would not have occurred to anyone. People would not even have defined themselves as Italian first and foremost. But in the course of the 19th century, this idea of nationalism spreads very rapidly and challenges or disrupts and undermines all the old multi-ethnic polyglot empires, the Tsarist Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the German Empire, certainly challenges them and helps lead to their collapse at the end of the First World War. So it's no surprising in this situation that some Jews began to feel that what they too needed to escape from anti-Semitism, to achieve equality within Europe, was a nation state of their own. This was a minority movement. There were, before the 1880s, that you can find a few voices who begin to talk about this. Most religious Jews had no interest in this because, from their point of view, one had to wait, a proper Jew had to wait for the coming of the Messiah to escape exile, to escape persecution. And only when the Messiah came and the end of days arrived could Jews be restored to their ancestral homeland. The house of David would be restored and we'd have what Christians would later call the kingdom of heaven on earth. So religious Jews were not interested in political projects of this kind. Certainly socialist Jews were also not interested. They wanted to change the societies they lived in so the Jews would have equal rights and better opportunities and be able to be full members of their society. And the many Jews in Central and Western Europe who had achieved legal equality in Germany and France and Britain and elsewhere also wanted to be part of their society. They wanted to be full citizens of liberal democracies. And the idea that they should pick themselves up and go somewhere else to try to achieve that seemed to them counterproductive or counterintuitive. In fact, it seemed to them to be accepting the basic arguments of the anti-Semites, who said the Jews were not part of European society or not part of German or French or British or whatever society, that they were aliens and didn't really belong. And that's exactly what many secularized, fairly assimilated Jews had been fighting to overcome. So Zionism was very much a minority movement. It got a little bit of traction in Eastern Europe in the 1880s and 90s as part of the reaction to the wave of anti-Semitic violence, aided and abetted in many cases by the Tsarist government, which was quite viciously anti-Semitic. And you begin to have in the 1880s, 90s, small groups of people who begin organizing themselves, raising money, and trying to plan the emigration of Jews out of Eastern Europe to a place where they can create a homeland of their own. Now, for most of these people, the only place that makes some sense to them is Palestine, the land of Israel, which has very powerful religious resonance, certainly for religious Jews, but even for Jews who have left religion in the strict sense. This was the place where, for Jews, the events of the Bible took place, where the events of the Jews when they had sovereignty were located. So it was not surprising that you have small groups of people who pick themselves up and try to establish agricultural settlements in Palestine, which is then part of the Ottoman Empire, with the hope of thereby launching an effort to achieve the national rebirth of the Jewish people, national redemption. It's a small-scale project compared to the vast numbers of Jews who emigrate and go to the United States or go to Western Europe. It's a drop in the bucket. It's a tiny, tiny minority. It's a couple of percent of that wave of out-migration from Europe. But it's there, and they do establish in the 1880s and 90s some numbers of new agricultural settlements because they very much want to become rooted in the soil. They feel the Jews should be sort of peasants. And you can see the influence here of a certain Tolstoyan romantic nationalism. They want to be rooted in their ancestral homeland. That's where they can connect to the land that was theirs once and which will be theirs again, and thereby be the vanguard of this project of national rebirth. Their numbers are small. We're talking of some thousands of people. Zionism becomes a modern international political movement only at the very end of the 1890s. And here the figure of Theodor Herzl is crucial, who was a Viennese journalist, actually of Hungarian origin, but moved to Vienna, the capital of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, made a name for himself as a journalist and a playwright, very assimilated, knew almost nothing of Jewish tradition from a non-religious family, but by the mid-1890s came to feel that anti-Semitism was not eradicable, it could not be eliminated. Partly he got this from covering the Dreyfus trial in France in 1894 as a journalist for a Vienna newspaper. And it was a big shock to him, although he'd already been moving this direction, to see French mobs in the streets chanting death to the Jews. And this was in Paris, which was the homeland of the Enlightenment, where the principles of the French Revolution had supposedly taken root, where Jews had full political equality, were full citizens, and yet anti-Semitism persisted. So Herzl latched onto this idea that the only solution to the Jewish problem was for the Jews to leave Europe or leave wherever they emigrated to, because he argued wherever they moved to, even if they moved to the United States, in a sense they would cause greater anti-Semitism by their presence. And in the end, this would lead to discrimination, tension, friction, exclusion, so they'd simply have to move onward. So for Herzl, the only way out was to have the Jews move somewhere where they could become a majority, where they could achieve a state of their own ultimately, and then with a state of their own would be accepted as equals by their fellow Europeans. And even if some stayed behind, they would then be like expatriates of any other country, and they would have a basis for equality. And it was Herzl who turned what had been a sort of amorphous, underfunded, not well-organized network of sort of local Zionist societies in Central and Eastern Europe into a well-organized, highly institutionalized, and quite effective political movement. He convened the first Zionist Congress, a meeting of delegates from across Europe in Basel, Switzerland in 1897, that the new Zionist organization he founded and which he led for the years until his death developed all sorts of institutions. It developed financial arms. It developed a land purchasing agency to buy land for Jewish settlement. And he took it upon himself to represent the Jews. He, in effect, declared himself the sole legitimate representative of the Jewish people and went from European capital to European capital trying to convince the powers of Europe to facilitate this project, to sign on to this project, to get for the Jews some piece of land somewhere in which they could establish their homeland. Herzl didn't care very much where that was. If you read his pamphlet, The Jewish State, he talks about Argentina as well as Palestine, because at the time many Europeans saw Argentina as this vast, empty place which was suitable for European settlement. And in fact, some Jews were going to settle in Argentina at that very moment. So he wasn't that concerned, but within a couple of years, the Zionist movement fixated on Palestine because it was clear nowhere else on earth had the kind of emotional resonance and historical depth of connection for Jews than Palestine, again, than the land of Israel, which Jews, whether they were religious or secular, conceived of as their ancestral homeland. So you have the launching of this movement, which is trying in terms of its day-to-day actions to get Jews to move to Palestine, settle there, create new settlements, new towns, and also claiming to act politically on behalf of the Jews. Now, it's important to remember that when Zionism emerges as an organized political movement around 1900, the last years of the 19th century, the first years of the 20th century, it's rejected by most Jews. Religious Jews rejected, Orthodox Jews rejected, because for them it's a false messianism. It's what Jews, from their point of view, need is not a nation state. They need to live according to God's commandments, which one can do anywhere. And again, await the coming of the Messiah for the eventual return to the land of Israel. And any human action is a way of preempting God. It's doing something which only God can do. So the Orthodox rabbis condemned Zionism at its origins very, very vigorously. They denounced the Zionists as idolaters. They worshipped the state rather than God's law. They were secularizing. They were leading the youth away from religion, which they also didn't like. They were substituting the nation for God's law. So Zionism was rejected from that quarter. It was rejected by most secular assimilated Jews in Western Europe, who again saw this as feeding into the arguments of the anti-Semites. They wanted to be equal citizens of Germany or Austria-Hungary or France or Britain. They didn't want to have to pick up and leave, and they rejected the notion that they should. And similarly, Zionism was rejected by the many Jews who were attracted to socialism, especially in Eastern Europe, who felt that Zionism was a sort of crackpot idea, a pipe dream, and that instead of running away to Palestine, Jews should stay and fight for their rights wherever they happen to live and demand equality and demand the transformation of society such that there would be a society of justice and equality, a society of socialism in which Jews could live along with non-Jews as decent human beings and have their own particular cultural distinctiveness recognized and supported instead of suppressed. So Zionism remains very much a minority movement among Jews for many decades, and really down to the Second World War, down to the end of the Second World War. And there were many other currents in Jewish life which were non-Zionist or anti-Zionist. In Palestine itself, which is the focus of the Zionist movement as it gets organized, its successes are limited. It does succeed in the years leading up to the First World War in bringing under its auspices some thousands of Jews to settle. Some in new agricultural settlements of various kinds, some in the towns, a new Jewish town which will eventually become a very large city. Tel Aviv is founded around 1909 as the first exclusively Jewish city in Palestine. But it's a slow process. It's sort of acre after acre, immigrant after immigrant. Its prospects for success still seem very limited in 1914. And largely because the Zionist movement is much less successful at getting a big power sponsor. Palestine is part of the Ottoman Empire. And the Ottoman government in Istanbul has lost a lot of its territory to foreign encroachment. It's very sensitive to what it sees as outsiders coming in and talking about taking away some other part of it, and especially Palestine, which for Muslims, of course, also has a lot of religious resonance. The Ottoman government sees these Zionist immigrants not so much as Jews, but as Russians. And Russia is the traditional enemy of the Ottoman Empire, and it doesn't like these Russians coming in and claiming the protection of their ambassadors and their consuls to get special privileges. So the Ottomans are trying to stop the Zionists from buying land. They're trying to restrict immigration. After 1908, when there's a constitutional revolution in the Ottoman Empire, there's suddenly a free press, there are elections to the Ottoman parliament, and you begin to have Arabs in Palestine taking note of the Zionist movement, raising objections to it. You begin to have local conflicts over land ownership, because as the Zionist organizations or as Jews buy land, the peasants who live on that land are being dispossessed. They're protesting. So you already have calls in the Ottoman parliament on the Ottoman government to restrict land sales, to restrict immigration. It's becoming an issue already. The Ottoman government has no interest in a Jewish state in some part of the Ottoman Empire, or even a Jewish majority in Palestine. And Zionism, despite Herzl's efforts and despite the efforts of his successors, also don't succeed in selling the idea to any big power in Russia, in Europe. Without whose support, they're not going to get very far. They lobby the British government, the French government, the German government, the Russian government, on and on. But they all see this as not a very likely prospect. They have other fish to fry. They're not very interested. So if you'd look at the situation in 1914, Zionism's prospects for success don't seem very large. Palestine is overwhelmingly an Arab country, and the great majority of its Arab population is Muslim, with a Christian minority. Increasingly, its Arab population are coming, or at least the more educated, urbanized elements, coming to see themselves as Arabs also in a new national sense, because nationalism is also penetrating the Middle East. And as the Ottoman Empire is getting increasingly decrepit and creaky and unable to protect itself, some of its constituent peoples, including both Turks and Arabs, come to see themselves a little less as Ottomans and a little more as Turks or as Arabs. So there's a growing sense of not quite an Arab nationalism yet, but of an Arab identity, which doesn't accommodate Zionism, of course, which sees Palestine as Arab, as it is, in fact, demographically, and has been for many, many centuries, and sees Zionism as a threat, still a distant threat. It's hard to imagine that there could be a Jewish state given the small size of the Jewish population, not all of whom are even Zionists, but it's becoming an issue, and there is a heightened sense of Arab identity, awareness, self-definition by 1914 already. The First World War changes the situation pretty dramatically, because the Ottoman Empire ends up joining Germany and Austria-Hungary in the war, because their main threat is Britain and France, so it's not surprising that they ally themselves with Germany and Austria. Britain has taken over Egypt next door. France has designs on parts of the Middle East, so the Ottomans feel Germany is a much better bet. Germany has no colonial ambitions in the Middle East, as Britain and France do. But that turns out to be the losing side as things develop. And by 1917, British forces invading from Egypt are conquering Palestine from the Ottomans and heading north along the coast. And the First World War gives the Zionist movement the opportunity to find the big power sponsor it had been dreaming of since Herzl's time for the previous 20 years. Herzl dies early on, but his successors continue his efforts. And in 1917, the British government essentially endorses the Zionist project. The British Foreign Secretary, Lord Balfour, issues what becomes known as the Balfour Declaration, in which the British government officially endorses the idea of creating in Palestine a national home for the Jewish people. The formulation was deliberately vague. The British spent a lot of time thinking about the wording, and they wanted to fudge it as much as possible. At the same time, they were making other promises to Arab nationalists who had revolted with British funding and military support against the Ottomans, and had promised the Arabs to help create an independent Arab state after the war, which the Arabs thought included Palestine. And at the same time, the British were making secret treaties with France and Russia about how to divide up the Middle East into new colonial spheres of control. So completely contradictory promises. The British created the greatest empire in the world, not by honest dealings exactly, but by doing just this kind of thing. From their point of view, the goal was to win the war, and whatever helped with that, they were willing to do. And after the war, they would sort out these contradictory promises. So they endure Zionism, and when the war ends and the victors, the allies, sit down at Versailles to work out the terms, they draw lots of new lines on the map. They create the Middle East more or less as we know it today. The modern states of the Middle East are drawn by the allies after the First World War out of the remnants of the former Arab provinces of the Ottoman Empire. And among other things, the British create a new entity called Palestine and say that the Balfour Declaration, their promise to support the Zionist movement in creating a national home for the Jewish people, whatever exactly that means, in Palestine, will be applied, will be part of their mission, their commitment in Palestine. The British don't rule Palestine directly because it's a little embarrassing at this late date, after all the talk by President Wilson of self-determination, to just simply take over as a direct colonial ruler. They create a new system, which is in reality a thinly disguised form of colonial rule, the mandate system. So technically Britain and France are mandatory powers. They're sort of trustees. And their job is to lead, in Britain's case, Palestine, eventually Transjordan and Iraq to independence eventually, and France is to lead Syria and Lebanon, which it gains control of towards independence. But in reality, the British and French are running the show. This is a tremendous victory for Zionism. It finally has the big power backer. And in the 20s and 30s, you begin to have migration on a larger scale into Palestine. So the percentage of Jews as of the population in Palestine gradually increases with setbacks. It's uneven. But you begin to get the laying of the foundations of a distinct Jewish society in Palestine. And of course, for Zionism, the goal is not to bring Jews to Palestine so that they assimilate into the indigenous Arab population. The goal is to create a separate Jewish society and eventually a Jewish majority and eventually a Jewish state in Palestine. So economically, politically, culturally, the drive is towards separatism, to separate from the Arab population, to build a whole Jewish society from, as the joke goes, from Jewish prostitutes, Jewish street sweepers, all the way up the social ladder, to the greatest extent possible, separate from the surrounding majority Arab society. And increasingly in the 20s and 1930s, this Jewish society, under British protection, creates the foundations, lays the foundations of a distinct Jewish society and even a future Jewish state, because this society has elected institutions, it has semi-governmental institutions, it has its own school system, it sets up its own military, its own paramilitary, the Haganah, which will eventually be the nucleus of the future Israeli army after 1948, and so on. It's an uneven process, and it's important, I think, to emphasize that none of this would have been possible without British support and protection. Because the indigenous Arab population from the beginning, once the Ottoman Empire was gone, began demanding independence for Palestine and opposed Zionism. From their point of view, the British had come in, they had, and with a promise to give their country to these outsiders. So the Arab national movement which emerges in Palestine is vociferously opposed to Zionism, which they feel is aiming at reducing them to a minority in their own homeland. They feel this is a gross violation of the right of self-determination. They're the majority. Palestine should be an Arab state, and with Jews as a minority. And certainly without being open to immigration from the outside, which threatens to change the demographic balance. So Zionism, from early on, but certainly quite visibly in the 1920s and 30s, faces growing opposition from the indigenous Arab nationalist movement.
You're listening to Zachary Lockman, A Brief History of Zionism. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or online our website, alternativeradio.org.
And it's only British protection that makes Zionism possible. The presence of a colonial government that's committed to fostering the Zionist project. Not always as much as the Zionist movement would like, there are tensions, but if we conduct a thought experiment and imagine that in 1918, 1917, the British do not take control of Palestine or agree that Palestine should be a state run by its Arab majority, it's clear there is no Zionism. That's the end of the story, because that Arab majority would simply put an end to this project, which threatens its its presence. It threatens it with dispossession. And Arabs come to understand very quickly that, you know, despite the nice talk of coexistence, and Zionist leaders talk a lot about coexistence, we can live together, there's plenty of room in this country for all of us. Inevitably, if you're trying to create a Jewish majority and a Jewish state in what is an overwhelmingly Arab country, this means dispossession. It may mean expulsion, but at a minimum, it means dispossession. It means that the majority will be transformed into minority in its own homeland. And as many Zionist leaders acknowledge privately, if not always publicly, anybody would oppose such a thing, right? Any indigenous population would resist such a thing. And the more far-sighted and hard-headed of the Zionist leaders were already saying very clearly in the 1920s, of course the Arabs will oppose us. And there's no peaceful resolution to this in sight, and the only thing that will decide this is superior force. So ultimately, we have to build up our strength such that we can overcome their resistance and carve out, by force if necessary, a Jewish state in this land, or transform it into a Jewish state, however long that takes, and by whatever means prove necessary. Most Zionist leaders were uncomfortable with that formulation, but I think that reflects the logic of the situation very clearly. And this is, I think, very graphically demonstrated in the later 1930s when, in 1936, there was a full-scale Arab revolt against British rule and against the Zionist enterprise, which British rule protected, which went on for 3 years and which was only crushed by the use of massive military force by the British, which in many ways broke the back of the Arab nationalist movement and set the stage for its defeat in 1948. But again, without British protection and support and military might, the growing Jewish community in Palestine, the Zionist project, would likely have gone down the drain or come to an end in one form or another. So by the late 1930s, Jews are an increasing proportion of the population, still a minority. They're a minority down to 1948. The Jewish population surges in the 1930s because of what's going on in Europe, essentially. In 1933, the Nazis come to power in Germany and begin stripping German Jews of their citizenship and persecuting them, discriminated against them. There's growing anti-Semitism elsewhere, in Poland, for example, which has a very large Jewish population, largest Jewish population of anywhere in Europe. And of course, this is also the period of the Depression, when the economic situation is very difficult for everyone. And many Jews would like to immigrate, but they no longer can go to the United States or go to many Western countries. The United States closes its gates to immigration in 1924. There's a wave of nativism, of reaction to immigration. And essentially, after legislation in 1924, you have to be from Scandinavia to get into the United States. It's very difficult for anyone else. The U.S. shuts the gates. And so does France and Britain to various extents. Whereas Palestine, at least, is relatively open. So a great many German Jews and Jews from elsewhere come to Palestine because they have no alternative. Even if they're not committed Zionists, this is where they can go to get out of the very difficult situation in their home countries. And so the Jewish population surges, which also sets the stage for the Arab revolt, because suddenly it seems to Arabs that this Zionist idea of a Jewish majority and Jewish state is becoming imaginable for the first time. It's no longer a fantasy which, you know, maybe will happen in several generations. Jews are now moving on a third of the population, and they're increasingly well-developed. It's increasingly has strong economic foundations, again, political institutions, military institutions, on and on. So it looks like a state in the making. And this touches off the revolt, the Arab revolt of 1936-39. The revolt is crushed and in many ways ends up strengthening the Jewish community in Palestine, because it's forced into self-sufficiency, it's forced to develop its military institutions, it successfully withstands this revolt with British protection, of course, such that by 1939, the Jewish community in Palestine, the Yishuv, led by and part of the Zionist movement, is much, much closer to being able to stand on its own, which is very useful because in 1939, the British government understanding that a new war is looming on the horizon, begins to distance itself from Zionism. It changes policy and basically says, look, we fulfilled our promises under the Balfour Declaration. We've supported you in creating a national home for the last 20 years. But now, enough is enough. We've done what we said. We need to reconcile Arab opinion, which of course is deeply alienated from the British, and the British need the Middle East with the coming war. They need Arab support. They need its oil resources. They need its strategic location. So they back away from Zionism. But by this point, in a way, Zionism has struck down strong enough roots in Palestine so that it can stand on its own, even without the kind of British support it had enjoyed for the previous 20 years. You then have the Second World War, which leads to the extermination of most of the Jews of Europe, which was the mass base which Zionism had always imagined it would eventually bring to Palestine. And Zionism emerged with the argument that there was no future for Jews in Europe, that ultimately they would have to come to the Palestine where they could create a state of their own. And even though only a minority did so, they always imagined